water.
I don't know if I hit that. I seem to have a better sound when you do it.
It's on the table.
Oh, okay. I'll call the Tax Conference Committee to order for Sunday, May 5th, 4th, 3rd, 4th, May 4th, Sunday, May 4th.
May the 4th be with
us. Yes. Nice to see you. And we have a list of items, and we know some of these can't get adopted, but we want to talk about them just to go through them. And so I don't see Ms. Manzi. I was going to have her do the military pay subtraction. Is she here? If she's not, we'll go to the next one.
She had something to finish in her office before she.
She is not yet here. Is Mr. Michael here?
Yes.
Yes, he is. We will take up the R&D sole proprietors. We want to talk to you about that a little, and we want to hear from the Department of Revenue, if that's okay. We know they have concerns, but we would like to hear about it. This is Representative Sarah Anderson's bill, and what she's really doing is extending the R&D credit to sole proprietors. So, you know, it's pretty self-explanatory, but if you want the citation, I'm going to ask Mr. Michael to explain the provision. Is that okay, or Senator Skoy?
That's just fine, Madam Chair, and you know, it's opening a fishing season next weekend, so we could do some research on those lures. Fine for that credit.
Would they qualify for that credit?
Well, if they're making lures, they would.
No.
Yes, they would.
They don't qualify.
Now, I come from a long line of people who tie their own flies, so I'm gonna have to disagree with that.
They won't qualify for the angel investor credit under your language, which is good, but they would qualify for this, which is not good.
Yeah. I think the fly fisher, the anglers of the world would never.
At some point today.
The love.
Yes.
Does anybody here know how to tie flies?
And
anybody? Trout?
Madam Chair, you know, I like the new terminology of anglers as opposed to fisher people because that is very cumbersome. But anglers is good.
That's what they are, anglers.
Anglers.
So nobody here knows how to tie a fly? Has anyone ever seen one? Somebody do it? Set
chair.
Up?
And
then, oh, yeah. Yeah. It's an art. It's
Madam
an art.
Chair, we have a tremendous fly fishing in southeastern Minnesota
yes,
on the
river.
There. And we also have a new world headquarters of a fly fishing company that ties the lures. Impressive.
Oh, really?
World headquarters.
Very good.
So for people who don't do fly fishing, they don't realize that Minnesota truly whitewater and all kinds of locations in Minnesota are some of the best in the world.
Well,
for fly fishing, Mr. Chair.
I think up the North Shore on
yes.
those creeks,
oh, yes.
it's very, very popular.
I grew up having my father ask me where the needle-nose pliers were, and that's something all fly people who tie their own flies understand what that means. Senator Gazalka?
I just said, I've been fly fishing up in Arkansas, in Colorado on the Arkansas River.
We should go right here.
So, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Did you dip into your father's tool?
No. I did not. I never really learned how to tie flies. I think it was more of a sexist time. But my brothers were masters. But I grew up with lots of people doing a lot of fly fishing. And it really, if you've not done it, it is it's an art. It's very difficult, right, Senator Gazalka? And it's an art. It's an art form, really, to master. And it often takes place in the middle of the night and all kinds of strange times during the rain. And
And it's the casting and the kind of fly and
oh, you,
all
yep.
the very stuff. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Representative Downey.
Well, the governor's press person, that's one of the former
fly angler.
I don't know. Yes. Fly angler. Yeah. Angling and fly fishing. I don't know if they go together.
Senator Gazalka.
Speaking of fishing, I want you all to know that I went back home last night and got up this morning, went for a walk, and looked across the road to Gull Lake where the governor's fishing opener is, and the ice is totally off. So we're all good.
Oh, great.
No, but where do you get shrimp and crab and oysters?
Red lobster.
Not here. Not here.
I do know the difference.
I can tell you how to catch crabs.
It'd be a delicacy.
The good. Angler Act.
Here, Preston, Minnesota.
Right.
Yes.
You can do fly.
It's really not what
under the water. You can do fly fishing.
You go stand in the water and you wait for the crabs to come.
They come and grab on.
I think a lot of people prefer to fly.
Talk about an art. It's crazy. They can quickly go
on. Yeah, I'm sure.
Water.
Are we ready for Mr. Michael? And then we'll ask Commissioner what he thinks about this provisioner.
Sure.
Provision.
Yeah.
Okay, then we can go back to her after this. So, Mr. Michael, can you tell us about the R&D credit for sole proprietor bill that Representative Anderson has in the House tax bill?
Madam Chair, members of the conference committee, this the House provision is in Article 4, Section...
I think you got to...
Article
there you go.
4, Sections 9 and 10 of the House bill, which is on the side-by-side on page 20.
Page 20.
And if you want to look at the bill language, it's on page 55 of the House bill. Under current law, individuals who are partners or shareholders in an S-corp or a member of an LLC that is taxed as a partnership are allowed the R&D credit for their research expenditures. However, if you operate as a sole proprietor, and this may be a business that has no entity, or it has an LLC that's a disregarded entity, and so you're filing as a sole proprietor under Minnesota law, you are not allowed the research credit. What the House provision does is to extend the credit to sole proprietors to treat them in the same manner as partners and shareholders in S corporations. There may be issues about the fact that you can claim this credit even though your trade or business has not shown income, and you can use it to reduce the tax on other incomes such as wages and salaries or investment income like interest and dividends, and that is correct. We have an amendment that would restrict the credit to instances where they meet the profit test that's currently in the Internal Revenue Code, which we've sent to Revenue to look at, but is still in a sort of a tentative stage. So that's a description of the provision.
Okay, great. And Ms. Manzi is now with us, and I don't know who's got that amendment. Do you have that, Ms. Manzi?
Members of the conference committee, in the last half hour, I've been in communication with Mark Peterson at the Department of Revenue, and I have that amendment, but Mr. Peterson didn't think that amendment really had any effect because he thinks that the reference to federally qualifying research expenses already accomplishes what that amendment would accomplish. However, I discussed with him what the department had proposed in its, in the discussion in its fiscal note or in its drafting and technical memo. They're sort of running together for me. But they had proposed limiting the research credit for all individuals, so both the S corporations and the partnerships that are allowed the credit under current law, and the sole proprietors who would be allowed the credit under this proposal, to income resulting from the trade or business that had the research expenses. And we didn't think that the House members would be interested in limiting something in current law. But I worked with Mr. Peterson and just before I came over here sent him a draft of an amendment that would limit the credit in that manner just for the sole proprietors. And I think that may address some of the department's concerns expressed in the fiscal note. We're waiting for the department to review the language of that amendment. And then, of course, you will have to consider if it's something that you want to pursue.
Okay, great. So we can take a look at that amendment when it's prepared and before us later today or maybe some other time. I don't know if we're going to make it be done tonight. I don't really want to say tomorrow since we were trying for tonight. We might be looking at it tomorrow. Mr. Chair?
Madam Chair, I think that we would have a pretty good chance of tonight, but maybe others would think tomorrow.
What's wrong with those other conference committees, Mr. Chair, and other conferees?
My mother taught me if I can't say anything nice to not say anything at all.
My mother taught me.
Representative Slocum? What do you think?
My mother taught me if you can't say anything nice, come sit by me.
<Get it. laughs> Okay, so we'll look at that amendment at another time, but we want to hear the department has concerns, and so we'd like to take the time to hear them. So, Ms. Starr, I guess.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think what I'd want you to know that I'd want you to know that it's widely acknowledged amongst tax professionals that this is one of the most complex areas already in federal law and in Minnesota law because we follow the federal R&D credit for its base rules. Determining what expenditures qualify for the credit is a fact-intensive investigation. Taxpayers use outside consultants and internal tax personnel, including their scientists and engineers. They spend countless hours assessing and documenting the actual or possible research activities that qualify for the credit. And I can tell you as an example, just in the partnership and S Corporation context alone, the department has trained 38 auditors to be available for working an R&D credit audit, and that it takes about 15 to 20% of their time. So that's the equivalent of 5 to 8 full-time auditors that are already engaged just in the audits of the R&D credit for partnerships and S corporations. So that doesn't even include the C corporation side. It's complex, and we think that it will become more complex with sole proprietors because there will be cases where we will be engaged in a discussion with taxpayers about whether or not they are engaged in a trade or business. So unlike partnerships, you know, it takes at least two people to make a partnership, so there's less likely that they're not actually engaged in a trade or business. And S corporations require the business to go through the process of incorporating and then making that S corporation election. So you don't really see that level of complexity there. But we expect that level of complexity to incur in the sole proprietor business. So, for example, we would expect to see fishing lures as an example that came up from one of our auditors. That we would have people who genuinely believe that they are engaged in a trade or business and make that argument, but really this is an extension of their hobby. We would certainly appreciate if you go down this path that you include the limiting language so that the credit is only against that income which is being produced from the business engaged in the research and development. Thank you.
Highlighting your concerns, so there's further discussion from members. Thoughts from the Senate, Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We heard this in committee, and you know, I thought they made a good case, but I hadn't heard Ms. Starr's conversation. And I think at the end of the day, I have a S corp, and it doesn't take that much to make that step. But if that's what it took to participate in this, then that maybe is not asking too much.
Skoy, thoughts on the sole proprietors receiving the R&D credit?
Well, Madam Chair, I, like Senator Gazalka, was applying it to myself, and I was thinking of my farm and the research that I do. And shoot, I'd be heading for credits, I think. And I don't know about that. That's just part of doing the farm work, I think, not necessarily needed. I don't know that we would want to be going down that road with individual farmers doing research on their farm and getting credits for that. But maybe. We're doing a lot for farmers in the proposals from the House this year.
Just send them a check.
Ms. Starr, how is research defined for purposes of receiving the credit? I don't think anyone can just say they're doing research.
Oh, good.
No, Madam Chair, not everybody can claim that they're doing research. The research must be undertaken for purposes of discovering information that's technological in nature. Substantially all the activities related to the research effort must constitute elements of a process of experimentation. And the intent of the application of the technology must be that it'll be useful in the development of a new or improved business component. And understanding what that means and unpacking all of that is what causes tax professionals and department professionals. Lots of talking.
Madam Chair,
I wouldn't normally bring a hypothetical up, but being as we have a little bit of time today. So a farmer is doing a yield trial, and he's experimenting on varying types of fertilizer. And he flies different fertilizer onto his field and then uses his GPS yield monitor to harvest those plots separately and analyze the yield differentials to see if the nitrogen application had an impact on his crop and whether it was a return worth doing in future years. Would that be considered research?
Star, is that research?
Madam Chair, members, my instincts are no, because I didn't hear about the development of a new or improved component of the business. But I want to qualify this by saying this is difficult, and but I think the answer is no.
There's good.
Yeah, we'll work on that next year.
Well,
David's cellmate.
It is complicated. I understand that. You know, Representative Anderson has spent a lot of time working on R&D issues in general. And as part of her work, actually, she influenced me. It was in 10 when I became the chief author of the refundable R&D credit. It's part of the 2010 jobs bill. That's what it was. And that was going great guns, and then we repealed that last year with a deficit because it was costing us $83 million of biennium. That's just the refundable portion. And that was, in my mind, while folks still wanted it, which I understood, I wanted to repeal it because these were companies that had no state tax liability who were receiving $83 million in taxpayer money for their good work, for research and development. I've tried to take kind of a middle ground approach in these issues, yet I think there's a lot of sole proprietors, and we heard testimony from some in the tax committee who make a really good argument that what they're doing is no different than, as Representative Senator Gazelka said, some other folks who are organized other ways. And I guess the answer to them is just, well, then go get organized that way if we don't adopt this. But, I think Representative Anderson's on to something, and I hope some time to think about it some more.
You know, and Madam Chair, I think it looks like we might have just a little more time to contemplate this, so I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Manzi's here, as was said before, and I was just wondering if Ms. Manzi can describe for you our military pay subtraction for the active guard. Ms. Manzi.
Madam Chair, members of the conference committee, the House's military pay subtraction provision would extend the current law subtraction for National Guard and Reserve members to include members of the National Guard who serve in active guard reserve status and also to include individuals who are called to duty for purposes of administration by the Adjutant General. By way of background, both the National Guard and the reserve components of the military are part-time enterprises where people serve for a limited number of weeks or days per year unless they're called to active service, and then they become part of the active service military. But while they're in those reserve components, of course, they're also rather big operations, so they need people to administer them and to run their operations. So both the reserves and the National Guard have this service status called Active Guard Reserve, and those are the people who work full-time to run either the reserves or the National Guard. Now, through a quirk of how our military pay subtraction is in statute, if you are in the reserves and you serve in active guard reserve status, then your pay may be subtracted and is not subject to state income tax. But if you are in the National Guard and you serve in active guard reserve status, then your pay may not be subtracted and is subject to state income tax. Then there's this other smaller group who are called to serve by the Adjutant General, and that would then be the only group left if we were to extend the subtraction for the active Guard Reserve in the National Guard. And that small group, I think there's certainly under 50 people. I'd have to pull out the revenue estimate, but there's very few people in that last category. So when Representative Mary Murphy introduced this bill, she chose to include both the roughly, I think, 900 National Guard, active Guard Reserve members, and the something under 50 people in this other status under Chapter 190. So if the House language were enacted, then the military pay subtraction would be simplified in that all active service military pay would be exempt from Minnesota state income tax. So, Madam Chair, yes. I'd also like to add the fiscal note that you have in your possession shows a fiscal cost for this. Ms. Templin subsequently had some communications with the Department of Revenue, and I believe that they have retracted the fiscal cost for this provision. And Ms. Templin can speak to that.
Ms. Templin?
Madam Chair, the fiscal note, there was, they reduced the department in communication with the department and the CFO. There was some discrepancy with the FTE count, and they have reduced the FTE count, the FTE count, which affects the expenditures, and have reduced it by $11,000 in fiscal 15.
Mr.
Madam Chair, members, that's called Senator Rest sharpening the pencil.
Senator Rest?
Could have actually just used a nub on that one.
Oh, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Guys practice these comebacks before you come in here?
I don't know where they come from.
Mr. Chair, what do you think of this provision?
Well, Madam Chair, it's interesting, and I know that over the last number of years, the folks that have served in the National Guard and the Reserve have been in active duty a lot, and I think that contemplating including them in some of this and expanding that number of individuals is something that we should be considering. I would like, if House or Senate staff can give me exactly how many it is and what the cost is. And then the only question I have is, so we go and do this change, and the world returns back to a more normal time where these individuals were morally just doing a weekend a month at Little Falls. What would be the status of their eligibility under that type of scenario?
Great question, Ms. Manzi.
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, the way current law is written, it doesn't have so much to do with being called to active service. Being called to active service, that pay is exempt. When people serve their one weekend per month and their 2 weeks of drill at Camp Ripley, that pay is also exempt under current law. As is the exempt of, as is the pay of Minnesota non-residents who serve in Minnesota. All military pay earned by someone who has a Minnesota filing requirement is exempt and would continue to be exempt, except for the active Guard Reserve members of the National Guard and this something under 50 people who serve at the call of the Adjutant General. Ms. Templin has the fiscal note for the revenue estimate for Representative Murphy's bill, which included both groups, and it shows that there would be 953 people affected by this provision. And if that were enacted, then it simply all would be exempt and would continue to be exempt into the future.
Thank you.
Senator Scoy.
And Madam Chair, this small group of people that are not being included in this, why are we not?
Mr. Chair, we are including them.
Yeah.
Ms. Manzi, you want to confirm that?
Madam Chair, that's correct. The provision that's in the House would result in all military pay earned by people with a Minnesota filing requirement being exempt from state income tax.
I thought I heard something different.
And Mr. Chair, I should say that issue that was just clarified, is one of disagreement amongst the supporters of this legislation. I mean, some people came and argued, well, but those folks, that's their jobs, and they shouldn't be exempt. And, you know, I mean, you can kind of hear the argument both ways. And, you know, we just decided we would include everyone. So I hope it sounds like you that's your preference if we proceed anyhow.
Madam Chair, if we're moving forward with this, I would think we would include everyone.
Mr. Chair, so we can talk about this again, but, you know, I do have one thought, as I know Senator Coonan is extremely knowledgeable on these issues. You know, if he maybe wants to take a double look at some of the issues you've raised and think about all the provisions that are going on in both bills, it'd be great to get that input. And I think Representative Torkelson knows a little bit about that, too, and wouldn't be bad for maybe some folks who really deal with veterans issues a little more than some of us to work on that a little bit. And I don't know if Senator Coonan would be willing to do that.
Madam Chair, I would. And from what I hear of the provision so far, I like it, but I would like to take a closer look. So thank you.
Thank you. We'll just lay that one over for now, if that's okay. And some of these on here we're not going to do because we're working on them to try to find some agreement. So the next one I have is, I thought we could hear about the governor's dependent care credit proposal, and then we would skip the next two, which are sales tax related. But we did want to ask you about our volunteer firefighter program again, see what you think about that. But first, if that's all right with everyone, we want to learn more about the dependent care credit. Commissioner Franz.
Madam Chair, members, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about this. One of the things that we've talked about, this committee has talked a lot about, and that's been the progress we've made thus far already with Tax Bill 1. And I think the overwhelming bipartisan support of that bill does show how much we've got done. And I think under your leadership, Madam Chair, getting that federal conformity piece done early enough, although it was late in the season, it was early enough to get accomplished and get those things done. And we're very pleased with the federal conformity that was completed with that tax bill, and I also want to give credit for the Senate for coming up with an expanded working family credit, which I think added a lot to the federal conformity bill. You know, the other thing that we obviously did, we were able to repeal those business-to-business sales taxes, and before the warehouse tax even took effect, made the first increase in the estate exemption for almost over a decade, going from $1 million to $2 million, and eliminated the gift tax. But what I wanted to talk to you a little bit about today was the overall progressive effect of the first tax bill was pretty significant. And one of the things that we talked about that I had a chance to testify at the House Tax Committee was the governor's expanded child care credit. We wanted, in the interest of giving the committee an opportunity to consider all sorts of options as you complete your work. I know you have a lot of opportunities before you, and there's already challenges in reaching agreement on some of these targets. But I think one of the things we wanted to at least put on the table for this committee to consider was expanding the child care credit. Right now, after the changes we made in the first tax bill, there are about 36,000 households that now receive the child care credit. It's about a $400 average credit. There's an income cap on the current credit, though. So if you earn over $39,000, you're not eligible to receive the credit, which is a pretty low limit on that credit. The state spends about $16 million a year per year on this credit. Now, the maximum credit is $720 for one child and $1,440 for two. Now, the child and dependent care in Minnesota is linked to the federal credit, but it is different. Both the child care credit and the working family credit for years in Minnesota have been separate credits that have different limits and different credit amounts, making adjustments to the federal credit. The governor's proposal would have linked the state credit with the federal credit and conformed it entirely. One of the things we've been hearing a lot about is the fact that we've had such a rising cost for child care in this state, and it's increasing, in fact, higher than the rate of inflation. So one of the main differences with the Minnesota credit and the federal credit is that the Minnesota credit is income limited. The federal credit is not. The Minnesota credit is refundable. The federal credit is not. The Minnesota credit allows an applicable percentage of qualifying child care expenses for children under the age of 13 and disabled dependents. Now, the Minnesota credit starts to decrease at incomes above $25,000, and it becomes completely unavailable for those earning over $39,000. Now, one of the things, as I mentioned, we know that the rising cost of child care is really becoming an important part for Minnesota families. Right now, about 71% of mothers work outside the home. And about 4 years ago, there was about a 77% of mothers worked outside the home. So we've seen a decrease in the number of mothers who work outside the home. Child care costs have risen dramatically. For all those in this room who have children who are in child care, you know that. The average cost today for a child care center is about per month, or about a little over $10,000 per year. Now, we believe this expansion of the credit would help women with both economic security and giving them an opportunity to work outside the home in a financial sense. It gives them some opportunity to pay for those child care costs. I think one of the things that when we made the original proposal in the governor's bill, it was a larger proposal. It would have completely eliminated any income cap in the credit, and that would have expanded the child care credit to over 170,000 families as opposed to just 36,000 families, and the credit would have been increased to $523 on average. But it did come with a price tag of about $71 million for this first biennium and about $75 million per year in the next biennium. What we would like you to consider and propose today is what we call a compromise, and that would be to increase the maximum credit but start the phase out at $70,000 of income instead of at $25,000. This would make 94,000 households eligible for the credit. It would increase the average credit. It would be about a $477 average credit. This would really expand it to 58,000 new families. The new maximum would be $2,100 for two dependents and $1,050 for one dependent. So those earning above $43,000 but less than $70,000 would be eligible for the full credit for two dependents or for one. Now, the credit would not be available for families with one dependent that earn over $82,000 or families with two dependents over $94,000. So the phase-out would begin at $70,000, go to $82,000 for those with one dependent and go to $94,000 for those with two dependents. This would conform completely to the federal credit, but it would have an income cap. It would remain refundable. We would also retain, some of you may remember, that we have a special Minnesota eligibility for child care providers and newborns, which is unique to Minnesota. It would retain those. This revised proposal would cost about $32.2 million in this biennium and about $31 million for the next year, first year of the next biennium, and $30 million for the second year. And the reason this we think it works is because it's a targeted change. It really is going to help those Minnesotan families in the middle class. It provides a credit that's just not available right now. And it also expands the potential for dependent care, which really isn't being utilized very much right now because the income cap is so low. Just to, the final analysis, I just want to give you two quick examples and obviously be open for any questions if you have. So right now, just as an example, I think it's always helpful to look at what it means for families. If you had a construction worker, for example, making $30,000 a year and his wife was making, you know, $35,000 in her job, and they have a combined income of $65,000 but have two children, one age of four and one the age of seven, they could spend a lot of money, but anywhere around $15,000 is a pretty good guess for what they might spend for their two kids per year. Under the current state dependent care credit, they do not qualify because of the income cap. Under the compromise proposal, they would receive $1,200 per year to help offset those costs. And one more example for disabled dependents. Under current law, if you're a disabled dependent living with your care provider or your family, you are eligible for the dependent care. So, for example, if you had a woman living with her son and daughter-in-law, even though they're making $65,000 a year, the out-of-pocket cost for someone who's disabled going to example senior care centers throughout the year can be $11,000 or more a year. So under the current proposal, they would qualify and they could get up to $600 in assistance for qualifying expenses. And finally, one other area that I just want to mention that I think is pertinent to what we've been talking about, especially for the Senate side and looking at trying to help those folks, those kids with special needs. Special needs child care, like child care programs for kids with autism, for example, can help moms and dads with their work. Just like traditional daycare, These expenses may qualify for the child care credit and would become available for families earning under this expanded child care credit. And the other thing that would happen, obviously, is to the extent we expand this credit for the families, it makes other monies available for them to fulfill other needs of the family. So in the spirit of helping the committee reach those decisions that really are best for Minnesota, the governor feels strongly about this. I can tell you that the governor has a lot of ideas about taxes and tax policy, and sometimes we have ideas, but I can tell you rarely do our ideas ever make it into the State of the State Address. And as you know, the governor underscored this in the State of the State Address. So with that spirit of cooperation and compromise, I just wanted to make this known to you and be available for any questions you might have. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Questions? I mean, I will just say, Mr. Commissioner, please share with the governor. I really appreciate him bringing this forward. This is a very progressive approach, and I think you're walking through, as you described it, we all can hear the need. I'm a huge fan, personally, of the Working Family Credit because it targets people who need assistance, and I think this proposal does that really nicely. I will say I feel a little it's difficult to say that I'm having a hard time seeing how it's fitting in this bill. But I like that you reduced the proposal down from the original. You were adding 170,000 households, and then this gets to 94. You're basing it, an additional 94, based on those who need the most help. And I think if we can proceed with something like this in the future, that's what we're going to have to do. And even hearing that, it didn't even sound like enough, as you walked through that example. And the credit, does this credit, I guess one question I have is, what happens for the family with the third child and the fourth child? So you kind of got the first and the second. Does the family hit their max and that's it? Because I know that's been a discussion in the past, and there have been legislators in the past, in the time I've been here, who've tried to add additional expansions in the Working Family Credit to address that issue, and they're all cost items. So my guess is there's probably not much after that, but if you could let us know what happens after that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, two is the maximum. So you get the credit for two, and then that's the maximum. Yes.
Okay, Senator Squay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Franz, for making your and the governor's case. We have had this conversation before, and so I'm not going to repeat all of it. I'm not going to talk about the, many of the people can flex their child care costs, and the pre-tax dollars are worth more than the credit. So, some people are actually getting some benefit there, but that's not the real reason. I think there's a huge need for dollars going into child care in the state of Minnesota. And if you look at the needs in the current sliding scale, I think the cost to eliminate the wait list is $45 million. There's almost 8,000 families on the wait list. If we're going to put some money into child care, we should attack that first. And then beyond that, we should probably use the grant program that's available there and move up the income scale to start picking up these middle-class families. And so I've actually drafted a bill. It was too late for this year, but it's on my idea list for next year. To carry some thought over to the Health and Human Services Committee on funding child care. And it's probably the mechanism that I think would be the most useful and the best process to use. And I understand that is next year, but we're also in a supplemental year this year, and so it might be because of the size of the needs we would have to approach this in a full budget year, but well aware of the needs and certainly have some ideas and thoughts about how to start attacking those.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to make sure I'm understanding this. I think Senator Squay made a lot of sense that there's a lot of need for the children or the child care part, and I was kind of taken aback a bit in the governor's speech that, okay, we're short on what we're doing there. There's a great need there, but now we want to add in mom and dad, too, or elderly parents, dependent parents, or I suppose it could be anybody that might live in the home. Or I guess I'm not understanding, because now it looks like we're, okay, we're not even taking care of the children, but now we want to add in and leave some children not taken care of, but yet then add in elderly dependents. Maybe a little help here from the commissioner.
Commissioner, thank you for asking that. And as I understood that, it's the disabled. It's the provision for someone who's disabled. Mr. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members, and Representative Davids, in current law, the credit is available for dependents who are living in the home who are disabled. So all those things have to be satisfied. So our analysis just showed that it wasn't being used a lot, because folks under $39,000 typically have access to other kinds of programs that may assist them taking care of disabled people who live with them, typically parents, obviously, but not necessarily parents. And so this doesn't expand that current law. It's simply, we believe, by expanding the income limits, it would make it more available to people who might be able to use it to take care of a disabled person living in their home who is a dependent on their tax return.
Mr. Davids.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just reading the letter from the AARP, and it says that they want us to expand the caregiver tax credit for families providing care to their aging parents.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative, this proposal doesn't change current law. Current law requires that the person be disabled and living at home and a dependent. And obviously, to a great extent, that does include elderly parents in that situation, but it doesn't expand it to elderly parents. It is current law.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner.
Yes. Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I just want to make sure I understand the disabled part. I'm not necessarily opposed. I'm just trying to understand it. For long-term care, you know, typically, if you have a parent that's living with you and they can't do those activities of daily living, how do we then decide whether they're considered disabled? What is the disabled definition for, say, if it's 85 that needs to be with the family?
Commissioner, how is disabled defined?
Madam Chair, I'm going to need a little assistance on that definition, but there's a definition that you have to satisfy. If I could ask Ms. Starr to...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe the definition is about activities of daily living. And so I imagine like somebody who needs help getting dressed or feeding themselves, that kind of thing. And I think that what the commissioner is describing is that often in those situations when an elderly parent is still living in the home, people use for services something called senior daycare. I know I used that when I was caring for my grandmother. And senior daycare is expensive, and it's the kind of care that helps to keep somebody living in the home with family, even though they've reached a status of disability and dependency.
Well, just one more follow-up. I work in this area a little bit and have relatives that have needed it in our own family, and so I'm just trying to get a sense at what level they'd be eligible for. Is it like one activity of daily living? You know, because for a long-term care policy to kick in, typically it's two. I'm just trying to understand what's going on here, or is it? I guess that's what I'm trying to get a feel at. What is the minimum that aging parent would allow the family to be eligible for this benefit?
Ms. Starr, please.
Madam Chair, members, I guess at this point I have to say that we've reached, I don't know how many it is. I'm sorry. I'd have to look it up. And I'm sure it's part of the federal regs, and I just have to dig it out.
Okay. You don't know everything.
Madam Chair, members, I don't know everything. No.
Hey. See, in the House Tax Committee, every time Ms. Starr is there, Representative Davids asks if the deputy commissioner can come to the table. Every time. So I guess he just demoted her. Because he promotes her all the time. Representative Davids.
Well, Madam Chair, worked very well for then Assistant Commissioner Matt Mossman. from my district, his whole family, the Mossmans from Caledonia, so he was promoted to deputy. I'm just trying to be of assistance here best I can.
And see, Representative Davids believes the fact that he called then assistant Matt Mossman assistant, instead of calling him assistant, he called him deputy, is why, in fact, it's what Representative Davids calls you, that's what you become.
Well, let's not go there.
Commissioner. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, I was a little bit worried about where we were going with that. Representative Davids has referred to me in different ways throughout the last few years. So I'm a little nervous. But thank you.
We don't know.
Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
To the issue we're talking about, and not that there's not a great need for the seniors here, but the future demographics, you look at the next 5, 10, 15 years, this is really going to balloon. And so, you know, government may be asked at some point to come up with some various ideas to help folks out. Because I don't see the problem. The issue is not going away. It's going to become more intense on the elderly side as our demographics show that we're aging very rapidly.
Madam Chair,
that number is growing.
Please.
Yeah, to that point, I mean, the dramatic increase in seniors, and so we're going to have to come up with some solutions. You know, this could be the type of thing. You know, is it cheaper for government to have family try to pitch in here? I mean, that's the things that we're going to have to find an answer for.
I agree with that, and I appreciate that the governor's thinking about this and working on it, and, you know, at least for the House, and I'm sure the Senate feels the same. We would like to work further with you on it. You know, what Senator Scoy mentioned, I hope you'd consider that. We actually had a proposal like that in the House to repeal some credits and convert them instead to straight up paying for daycare. And that was one of them. We couldn't get it through all the way, but we tried. You know, I think that becomes part of the discussion, you know, with a credit also, you know, you're not the refundable part, but you lose some of the money on the federal as you go through the federal side of the form versus when you pay someone a dollar straight up, you get the whole dollar. So, you know, there's benefits to looking at it that way. In fact, we're hoping that the Senate might consider that on some other provisions that grants take you further than tax credits. But, you know, I do think the dependent care credit item for the disabled elderly, you know, we should talk about that. Senator Gazelka, I agree. You know, at the risk of offending somebody who might know more about insurance or finance, advising people financially, you know, I always have viewed the long-term credit as healthcare credit as a waste of money. You know, we spend, I don't know how much that is, $9 million a year, and nobody uses it. Nobody says,
what do you mean,
I could get
it. Uses it?
Yeah, the data on it is very poor. People just don't buy long-term health care insurance because they can get $100.
So it should increase?
You know, yes. We could take that $9 million and do more for long-term health care is what I would say. Mm-hmm. Similarly, you know, and these are things that offend people, but, you know, people don't donate their organs to get a tax credit. I mean, that is not why people donate a kidney. So, I mean, we confuse the good act with a tax credit when they should be funded instead. If they're legitimate purposes, they should be funded, and we shouldn't use the tax code. But that's my personal feeling on that. I hear Senator Scoy kind of open to thinking of a way to fund this need, and I think everybody, as Senator Gazelka has walked through, we know there's an emerging aging problem for all of us. So, Commissioner.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. That's a great discussion. It's a great discussion. I think one of the things we're finding is there is no silver bullet, if you will, that one of the things as the demographics hit this state and every state and these challenges come up, we do need to think in a holistic way. You're right. I mean, there's no one right way to do it, and I think the more we think about how to make these things work together and consistently, the better off we'll be long term. But thank you for your comments. I appreciate that.
Appreciate that. Thank you so much, Commissioner. Continuing to talk. Volunteer firefighters stipend. We have an amendment. We just not the provision, but we've been offering amendments to get them the order we want.
It was adopted.
It was adopted, says Ms. Manzi. Does everyone remember that?
The A-56.
The A-56. It was adopted. Okay, that's done. Oh, the next one is great. And I don't know who wants to tell us about this provision. If is it Ms. Dalton? This is, I hope you will all read the list. Commissioner, do you have the list? We don't have, we have what it really is. Amnesty for puppies and kitties.
Madam
Chair.
And
we want you to open your hearts as you hear amnesty for homeless puppies and kitties.
Abused and neglected.
And senators, we want you to open your hearts to Representative Gunther's proposal. Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for purpose of if anyone wants to know where it is in the summary, it's House Article 3, Section 32, and it is on page 16 of the summary. Essentially, what this deals with is the fact that a number of nonprofit animal shelters currently are not registered to collect and remit the sales tax, and they should have been collecting and remitting sales tax on their adoption fees on the pets that they were placing. A couple of them have come forward, and they have had some back audits and owe some money. This is a way to encourage all of these nonprofit animal shelters to come forward, register, and begin collecting the tax. The amnesty basically ensures that they won't face any back audits if they come forward and do this within the next 4 months.
Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, can we hear from Commissioner Grinch as to why we couldn't have, if there's some problems with this?
Which one of you would like to play Commissioner Grinch? Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, well, you know, this is a problem in the sense that, and this happens with a lot of other areas, it's not just this particular area, and when we do have enforcement problems, you folks get contacted sometimes, and these issues come up, and they percolate up, and, it's a problem for everybody. And we're not going to ever have a perfect enforcement system, and we're not going to ever get the word out for everyone to do the things they need to do, whether they start a business or they are running an animal shelter. It's unfortunate when this happens and people get going and they realize that they should have been doing something that they weren't. One of the things that, not just in this area, but frankly, we have really been working hard this last year and a half in voluntary compliance. We specifically did not request a direct compliance initiative this last year because we wanted to not increase the number of auditors and the number of examiners and try to hit a target. We wanted to take the budget that we got, which, by the way, we reduced our budget by $5 million. We're one of the few agencies to actually come forward last year with a reduced budget. But we wanted to take that budget and really get much better about outreach and education and working with taxpayers because I think it's something we want to accomplish for all tax areas. And we've taken that very, very seriously. This is an area that, you know, we're always kind of behind the ball, I'm sure. These things percolate up, and then we find out about it. We implemented a voluntary compliance program. And that voluntary compliance program is designed to reach out, make sure that we find these folks early on and get them registered and try to do it in a way that doesn't have a past tax liability. And to be honest, what we try to do is find people before the problem is severe, and even if it's a little bit of a past period, we have some flexibility in determining that. But that's why it's important for us, and that's why I'll reach out to Representative Gunther as well to make a commitment that we've already started in the department to get more active in particularly this area. There are a limited number of people doing this, and so it's not like it's hundreds of thousands of people. So we feel like we have the opportunity to reach out and contact these organizations. In fact, we want to have some outreach programs around Minnesota so that, because what happens when we have these outreach programs, we have these programs, people show up about it, it gets written about in the paper, and then someone says something to their friend, and their friend says, oh, by the way, you're running one of these shelters. I just heard that you need to collect tax on some of these, on your outputs when you sell these puppies and kitties. But so I think we really take it seriously that these issues come up in all areas, but particularly this one, because these folks are doing really great work. And it's important work that they're doing. We wouldn't want them to not continue to do this. They provide a service to our communities around the state. And so you know, we certainly will make a commitment to you. You obviously have to decide what you think is in the best interest of this committee to go forward, but we really are concerned about providing amnesty, because if it's this year, next year, you're going to have something else to consider in the year after that. We would rather take your direction and work really diligently to go into these areas, find these organizations, work with them, and get them up to date and working with us in a way that benefits them and benefits all of us. So that's about all I have to say as Commissioner Grinch.
Hey, Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, and in all seriousness, these are volunteers that are donating their time and treasure to protect and save animals that don't have a home. And I don't question you for a second, Commissioner, that you're trying to work with these folks and so forth, but the testimony committee, as I remember, was some of these folks were looking at quite a backlog due, and it would basically shut them down. And not that you want to go in and shut folks down. I'm not saying that at all. But in the future here, if, you know, and I don't question that you'll work with these folks, but I think we may have a few cases out there where they may have to actually be shut down. That's what this amendment on the bill would do, and make sure that doesn't happen. So, and I'm the guy that goes crazy driving down the road when I'm listening to Fox News, because that's all I listen to, because it's fair and balanced. And as I'm doing that, you'll hear these ads come on saying, I owed the IRS $200,000, but got by for $5,000. That drives me crazy, because I'm paying all that, and he's not paying what he should, okay? So I'm not coming at it from that angle. I'm not trying to get somebody off the hook, and in the future we'll be back with trying to get somebody else off the hook. That just makes blood shoot out of my eyes. I won't eat broken glass when that happens, because when they owe $200,000 tax liability and they get by for $5,000, that's not right. And I want to go after those folks, and I think the department's very professional in the way they do that, and they do a great job. So it's not like we're trying to get somebody off the hook here, but these are volunteers that weren't aware of what's going on. It may shut some of the facilities down, and especially out in rural Minnesota, there aren't that many, and we want to keep the ones open that are out there. So I don't think it's an issue of, you know, in the future we're going to be trying to, you know, and I'm sure we may. There may be something else we find out from our constituents that's important to us. But this is one that I think would just make it a lot easier for you, because then you could have your outreach and be looking forward and not backwards. So, you know, like I say, don't give till it hurts, give till it feels good. That's what we say in Fillmore County.
Yes.
Representative
Gazalka. Or Torkelson, I looked right at you and called you. Sorry, Representative Torkelson.
Senator Gazalka is a very handsome man, so. we are all becoming what we've been called today. But I do recall at the end of the book that the Grinch's heart grew twice its normal size. Just a couple of quick questions. Any idea how many of these shelters have gone through this process that you have collected some back taxes on?
Mr. or
Madam, I'm not sure, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members, I think that the revenue estimate identified that there were a couple, like maybe 200 of these entities registered as nonprofits in the state of Minnesota. I'm looking for maybe, or 130. And I think there are a couple that have come forward currently in the voluntary compliance program. And our sales tax division is right now, they've made a map of all of the places in Minnesota where these organizations exist. And they've identified where the centers would be, like this, like a locus where they could go out and do community outreach in an area where the most, right, where we could find good populations of these organizations to come forward. And they're making plans on how we're going to get out and educate these organizations and get everybody registered and moving forward.
Representative Gilzalka, I think Ms. Templin might know the. Did I do it again?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think it was Templin. Knows the answer.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Starr mentioned that the revenue estimate did have the detail, and it does. It says that there are 212 animal protection and welfare service organizations in Minnesota registered with the IRS as nonprofit entities.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the Commissioner, if this provision goes into law, would it in any way interfere with your efforts of outreach?
Madam Chair, Representative, well, no, I think our goal is whatever the committee decides to do, this is an issue that's been raised that we need to work on. And so if you decide to provide amnesty, then that will happen. But we will make it. This is something we have taken very seriously. And these folks, as Representative Davids mentioned, they're doing really important work, and we want to encourage them to do it. So we really feel by this outreach program, we can get them, notify them all, get them involved in a voluntary compliance program, and help them complete their books the way they want. So we want to do this regardless of the outcome today. It's important to us. Thank you.
I think we'll move on. I will just say that, you know, we have two amnesty provisions, and the Senate has one, durable medical, and we have Farm America in this one. And I do understand the true policy reasons why people, you know, don't want to have amnesty. And they're real, because they have other taxpayers lose their sense that that the tax system is fair and credible. So I understand that, you know, I've never been a fan of states that do these tax holidays, because people kind of wait around for the tax holiday and they go buy the school supplies or whatever. But I think, you know, when we do them, I understand from the department's perspective why they're not a good idea, because then other taxpayers watch them and, you know, wonder what that means. Will there be one for them? Or, you know, why did they get one? I don't understand that. So I get the policy part. I do think, you know, we've got some legislators have identified some issues, and, you know, I hope you just think about all of them, the durable, the food, the Farm America, and the puppies and kitties. And if, you know, that one doesn't rise first to the list, but we'll talk more about them, I'm sure. So thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Skoit.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quick. We are interested in cleaning up these issues also, but the Farm America one, I think, is resolved.
We've heard that it's in being debated in that committee, though, that can't make any decisions.
So
I don't think it's been adopted.
So we will just wait and see how they do. Okay?
Yes. Okay, so what's next on the list? Or do we want to recess now? Where are we? Would you like to talk about micro distillery before we could recess for a little bit? Is that okay? Okay. Micro distilleries.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, as I recall, yesterday Senator Skoit asked the department to rescore the fiscal notes because of the possible interaction of the possible omnibus liquor bill that possibly will be heard in the Senate tomorrow.
Possible.
Lots of possibilities.
So I maybe if there were just a fiscal note update, know where we're at.
Madam Chair, members, maybe during the break I could make a call to Dr. Okay. Paul Wilson and find out.
Okay. I think it's hard to have the conversation until we have the facts.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
I think that's fair.
Well, do you want to talk about the solar, or should we wait till later? And I guess I want to jump ahead also and ask if things are, if you guys are ready to think about the Duluth lodging yet.
I'd like to hold on that.
Hold on that.
But the solar?
Would you like to talk about that now?
We have an amendment we'd like the House to see.
Oh, sure. That'd be fantastic. Yep.
Adapt it, but we want to get it out and about. So
okay.
Is that amendment? Yeah, they're coming with it. And, Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
It's an amendment dealing with the land underlying the solar facility and how that the classification is. That's the issue that needs to be resolved. Once that's resolved, I think we can move forward on. I kind of view these as three provisions. We've got the personal property tax exemption, the production tax, and then the study. In the studies, the Senate's provisions, and the other two are the House's. But we were wondering if the House would contemplate this amendment, which the 8079, which would have the underlying land when it's in rural areas considered CI, I think it truly is. It's not agriculture. And that would eliminate confusion for assessors. It also would eliminate the possibility of a corporation having a solar field and coming in conflict with the prohibition on corporations owning ag land. And then toward the end of the amendment is the language that would say if you put one on your house or on your building, it doesn't change the underlying classification of the building. So we think that with this amendment, we could move forward on the other energy provisions that are in front of us.
Senator Rust.
Article and section in the House bill?
Mr. Silva, do you know? Assuming he drafted this.
Sylvia, yeah.
Mr. Sylvia? Do you know the citation?
Madam Chair?
Mr. Hines?
It's House Article 2, Section 3, page 13 of the House bill. And page 4 of the side-by-side.
Okay.
And, Madam Chair, you know, I should have gotten this information for the conference committee on paper, but I unfortunately didn't. I did see a proposed property tax, personal property tax impact on one of these proposals, and the major tax is in the personal property tax. It was, like, projected to be $3.5 million. Where the land tax was $50,000. So giving the personal property tax exemption to these facilities is the real significant tax ramification for these solar factories, farms, gardens, whatever you're going to call them, you know. But I don't remember. I think, Madam Chair, Mr. Ouellette might be able to provide us some information.
Mr. Ouellette, are you here behind a pillar back there? Hey, nice to see you. Over time, you learn where people tend to sit every day. It's always right where I can't see him, but he's just there. Mr. Ouellette.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I'm following the conversation correctly, because I was in back, we did do some estimation with some help from Xcel Energy on what the likely tax consequences would be of the change in law that's being contemplated. And based on that estimate, it does seem that the personal property exemption was the lion's share of the tax savings in this. We estimated that for a 200 megawatt facility, there'd be about a $3 million tax break in total. And about over 95% of that would be the personal property exemption. So the savings from how the land is classified is pretty insignificant based on the assumptions that Xcel came up with.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe to Representative Dabney, Representative Groffel had some amendments on the floor and through the Energy Committee to do something with this. What was he trying to do?
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, he was trying to get a study of this question rather than acting now. And there's still study conversations are still active out here, I believe.
If we voted that down.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, it sounds like there's some House support.
Well, Senator Scoy didn't pass the House.
I know, but was there a roll call?
I don't think there was a roll call.
If there wasn't a roll call.
I do.
Madam
Chair, I'm wondering if Mr. Hines could help me here. And I'm not quite sure what the intent of the Senate is here, because as I understand it, the production tax issue relates to the developer. The property tax issue relates to the farmer. Who or other individual who would be leasing the land to the producer.
Madam Chair, which would all be reflected in the lease arrangement?
Before I get you involved, Mr. Hines, what happens then, Senator Scoy, with existing lease arrangements? Because I guess the maybe I should go to Mr. Hines first, because if you can help me here, Ag class land rate is 0.5. And then if we can walk through what the rate is for CI, and then, of course, they'd fall under the state general tax as well. And so what's the difference between ag, what the farmer's paying on the ag land versus having this 2 acres, 10 acres, whatever it is, classed as CI?
Mr. Hines, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Davney, as you said, the agricultural classification is 0.5 for ag homestead, 1% for non-homestead. Commercial industrial would be a rate of 2%, basically, and in addition would pay the state general tax. So that's the relative difference between those two. Was there further?
Madam Chair, how could we, Mr. Hines, how could we quantify the state general tax? I'm trying to understand the difference between what they're paying now and what they would pay under the Senate proposal.
As Madam Chair, Representative Davney, at a real gross level, I think you could figure that's another percent. So it's kind of like a 3% versus 1%, okay, to get in rough terms. 3% versus a 0.5% compared to.
Thank you, Mr. Hines.
Madam Chair, but in the scheme of things, the majority of the tax break is in the personal property tax, and we're proposing to move forward on that. And that's the impact on solar. This is a local government issue. I just think we should really seriously consider this so that we can move forward on all the solar provisions.
Madam Chair, I'm open to it. What I need is I need to spend just a minute with the bill to make sure that we're updating the definition, which was part of it, doing the production tax, and then this. And if we're covering all the bases, then I think we can go here.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, it's exactly would be what I would expect you to ask. We would have asked the same thing. So, okay. Yeah.
All right.
So we'll just hold
Thank
on
you.
That, and we're going to recess. Okay, we'll recess for 30 minutes. Oh, Mr.
No,
Chair.
No, recess.
Okay, we're in recess. Thank you.
There you go.
Mr. Chair, we're going to we'll come out of recess and call Tax Conference Committee back to order on Sunday. And I don't think we have many things left to talk about, and then we were going to. Representative Davney, I'll ask you, do you want to talk about the solar and the study and the amendment, or were you not ready yet? Representative Davney.
Madam Chair, first of all, if staff could help, I've misplaced my copy of the amendment. I'm fine with going, if we want to actually accomplish anything tonight. I'm fine with moving the two provisions with Senator Scoy's amendment. Staff has informed me there's a couple of technical changes to the amendment.
So do you want to?
They were redrafting it rather than amending this. Understood from.
Okay, they
Mr.
need a few
Sylvia.
Minutes.
Yeah. Yeah,
so can we come back to that
Absolutely.
In 5 minutes or
Absolutely.
Something?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Scoy.
Just briefly, we would like to move the Senate provision with regard to the solar study. Representative Dabney and I have talked about that. I think you have an oral amendment or an amendment you wanted to make to our study language.
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, staff is going to help me with
that. So that'll be drafted also. With the understanding that probably is a Senate responsibility.
Okay, so those four items, really, a couple amendments and a couple base provisions, we'll adopt soon. Tell us they're ready.
Unless you want to share the cost on that study, we'd be happy to do that. No?
See, Madam Chair, some clarification. On the amendment we had just a little bit earlier that they're working on, just for clarification, they said CI was 2.0, I believe, instead of. It's actually $150,000 of value or less. It's 1.5. So just for the record, I thought it's
all right. That's
yeah.
true. Yes. Yes. Thank you.
Of course, there's.
Can we? We have a couple amendments to talk about while they draft other things. And one is, we've heard that the department wants to amend something to the PTR. Do you have an amendment on that? They're looking at us like, no. Yes.
No.
We could get that one passed out. And then, and that's just to get, we Ms. Manzi explained it to the conferees, and I think we're okay with that, so we'll just get that on. It's for our PTR. And so if someone can pass that one out, Mr. Beltrandi, thank you. We also, you could also pass out after that the amendment that we have to increase the renter's credit from 5 to 6%. That's the A64 to get it back in the order we would like, not the base, just what how is, we want our renter's credit to work.
Is there a cost?
We introduced the bill on the floor with that at 6%. Some amendments on the floor change it a little, so we're reworking things.
Could I ask Ms. McQuay what the impact on the spreadsheet would be?
I don't know. It's the A64, but again, it would just be amending to get it how we want it. We would buy it all.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
And so it's not adopting the renter's credit. Okay. It's just amending it the way we had originally wanted it. So there probably is a cost to that. And I don't see Ms. Templin, so I can't ask her. But in the meantime.
Just, Madam Chair.
Yes.
We've been doing everything we can do to try to reduce the costs on the spreadsheet.
I'm
a little nervous about.
Well, we dropped the other thing.
Some of the other stuff. Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
The other thing that was
right.
Dropping.
In. Sure.
But if that makes you uncomfortable, we can wait.
No, let's adopt the language.
Okay, so can we ask Mr. Cummings, who's telling us about the A66, which Representative Dabney will move the A66.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members.
And this is from the Department of Revenue. Ms. Starr.
Madam Chair, members, the department requested that some language go into law regarding administrative appeal rights. So normally we send a page-long document whenever we change somebody's return to let them know about their administrative appeal rights. And here we have 850,000 filers impacted by this these percentage changes to the PTR. And we're simply saying that if that's the only change to their PTR return, the department is not required to provide the information regarding the appeal rights. Nevertheless, taxpayers will retain all of their appeal rights. It simply minimizes the number of pages in the mailing. You'll notice in the fiscal note we've accounted for a one-page mailing going out to all 850,000 filers, letting them know about what's changed in their return. But for those where this is the only change, we won't have an additional page or pages with regard to the appeal rights.
So, Mr. Chair, the way we heard about it from Ms. Manzi, so that helps. That makes sense because we were trying to think about this as most people get their appeal rights mailed because they're being told their taxes are going up. This would be they're getting a little more of a refund. So it would just save the cost of mailing appeal rights. I don't think people will appeal to get a refund check. But Ms. Manzi, you want to jump in there?
Madam Chair, not on the appeal rights issue, but I just wanted to let you know that in the interest of efficiency, we included the change in the percentage from 5 to 6% in this amendment as well. You can, delete it from this amendment if you'd like and take it up in the earlier amendment, but it's both changes are in the A66. And as far as the cost goes, if you look at line 85 of the spreadsheet, the fiscal 15 cost for the renter PTR is $10.4 million, and then there's $100,000 in fiscal 16 for any original claims that had not been filed at the time that checks are being mailed out this year. So you would just divide that by 5 to get the cost for 1%, and that would be about $2.1 million of additional cost in spread across fiscal 15 and a little tiny bit in fiscal 16.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, just so I understand, so did I hear $2.1
million? And I apologize. That's what she said, but I did not see that they had combined the two amendments. So we could just dispense with them both on the A66. But again, the 2.1 is how the bill was introduced, left the House, and then
basically on these two items.
And then
not on the
that
record.
We would go back to 6% when we got there, but we took a language change.
Could I ask Ms. McQuay?
Sure.
Ms. McQuay, What is that doing to the spreadsheet for the Senate? Is that what are we carrying for that number? Is this an increase on our? Well, we're carrying your stuff on our spreadsheet.
Thanks.
Well, we want to know what's going on. Well, we try to look at what's going on.
2.1, I think.
2.1? Okay. Thank you.
Increase.
Yes.
Madam Chair, members, I was doing the calculation as Ms. Manzi was explaining it. So the 2.1 does come from going from a 5% to back up to a 6%. And I did not understand if any of the other, the subdivision 3 carried a cost as well. But I can check with that, and it would increase the cost by $2.1 million.
Yeah.
That's all I needed. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
A question either for the department or Ms. Manzi, just clarification. Does subdivision 3, is that drafted inclusive of the change in the ag credit that is proposed as well? Or does that somehow not apply? Or does this not apply to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I believe this only applies to the homeowners and renters and not to the ag.
Madam Chair, Ms. Starr, do they not need it? Does the department not need it in the case of the ag credit proposal in the House language? Mr. Monk?
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, the appeal rights occurs because the department is making an adjustment to a refund that they're currently, under current law, they're entitled to. The farmers do not, they're basically paying local property taxes, and we're going to send them a refund, and we are not adjusting their tax in any way, so it's just an additional refund. So I don't think the department would have to notify them. There's nothing that would trigger, the department's not adjusting their tax or refund that they get under current law.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure we were covering the bases. Thank you all. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Not all those in favor say aye.
So,
aye.
Just a question. So that the renter's PTR right now, you're carrying at 10.4, and this would move it to 16.5. Is that correct?
No. But, you know, everyone is shaking no, but Ms. Templin and Ms. Schiller are both not here, and that's who could tell you.
Ms. McCoy?
Madam Chair and members, the House's April 1st spreadsheet, and this would be on the spreadsheet before they were on the floor or before they had passed off the floor, carried a 6% renter PTR at $12.5 million. The 5% as passed off the floor, 10.4, which the difference between those is the 2.1.
Thank you. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Or thank you. That's the A66. So we don't need to do the A64. So that's done too. And there's nothing we have listed under here. Amendments, local sales tax. I don't think we want to do anything there because that's all getting worked on. And then I have one for a bridge name change. And we don't have it quite right, but I'll just tell you what it is right now. You guys have heard me talk about this bridge before. We have a bridge in Bloomington called the Old Cedar Avenue Bridge. And we want to make sure that it's always named that. It's been that named that forever for the citizenry and the people of Bloomington. And it's actually, that's really its name. It was the Cedar Avenue Bridge, which was Highway 77. And then when the new one was built, they called it the Old Cedar Avenue Bridge. But it goes over a channel in the Minnesota River that some people refer to as the Long Meadow Lake. It's not really a lake. It's just an overflowage in the Minnesota River. And there are some people who, when they're on city staff, who call it sometimes the Long Meadow Lake Bridge. But no one knows where that is, and nobody calls it that, and that isn't its name. So I really want to make sure that it doesn't get forever named as it's repaired something that is not called by anybody who lives in the area. So I'm just wanting to put that in law, but Mr. Michael and I were working on the language, and we want to make sure it's exactly right with the right number of bridge, so I'll just do it on Tuesday.
Well, Madam Chair,
that's what it is.
To that point, I'm a little concerned. I'm going to follow you on this one. I think it's a pretty important issue, but my only concern was it could possibly be named the Commissioner Franz Bridge. Yeah, that would make it so that could never happen, but I'll, in deference to the chair, I'll go with you.
And, you know, and this bridge has such a history with the city and with me, but I will remind folks last year, and I know, and I want to thank people again for dealing with a complicated situation for me, but it reminds me, we actually had folks who were trying to get private companies to do donations and then try to name the bridge after those companies.
You could call it the Old and Chesky.
Well,
yeah. All American bridge.
Well, and, you know, some of those were the names, yes. And, you know, thankfully, the historic folks deemed it of historic status, so that cannot happen. But I was fighting that off last year, having the bridge get named after, you know, a big Minnesota. So so now we're just trying to get it in law. It's clean up from last year, what the accurate name is. So thank you very much. And I'll just bring it up Tuesday because we're still working on it.
And, Madam Chair, I apologize. I was interrupted middle of your conversation, but did you say you were going to call it the new old cedar?
New. We're just going to keep it the name. It's always been since 1910. So thank you. And I think other than the only one I have left is the sales tax exemption for motor vehicle local government, which is a provision that we have, House Article 3, Section 17. I'm looking at Ms. Dalton, and we think we've never talked about it. And then we could do that and then go back to the solar and adjourn would be my thought. So, Ms. Dalton, can you tell us about what page sales tax exemption for motor vehicle local government, House Article 3, Section 17? My guess is it's a non-general reading the description. Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's on page 13 of the summary. And essentially, when we exempted townships several years ago from the general sales tax, we also made a provision to exempt their road maintenance vehicles from the motor vehicle sales tax. When we enacted the county and city sales tax exemption last year, we did not exempt their road maintenance vehicles. This essentially does that. It has no general fund implications. Because motor vehicle sales tax is all dedicated to transportation.
Senator Rest.
Looking at the spreadsheets, that's a $4.3 million hit in 16-17 to the
motor vehicle.
Transportation. Ms. Templin?
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, on page 11 of the spreadsheet, it's the non-general fund section. This provision has a $2.6 million impact in the tails to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund and a $1.7 million impact in the tails to the Transit Assistance Fund.
And I can just see the hackles raising on the heads of the wherever hackles raise on members of both bodies, transportation committees. I'm just telling you that's probably going to cause a little bit of consternation because it's not something that's the general fund. It's elsewhere we shouldn't assume control over those funds without their agreement.
Yes.
Nice idea, but
and Ms. Dalton's looking at me. You know, I hear what you're saying. I actually am one of the people who thinks that we should assert all the control over the transportation committee's attempt to control taxes, since we're the tax committee. But I hear what you're saying. You know, I guess I thought it was a good idea to include. I think it's Representative Swazinski.
I think so.
But I didn't know it was that expensive, honestly. But we were thinking they're paying a sales tax to buy a. They're using road taxes to pay to buy equipment that fixes the roads. It kind of is silly, but I guess I was thinking it was negligible. Ms. Dalton, what am I not understanding?
Madam Chair, actually, I think that's what you just said is correct, that these taxes essentially go to pay local local road projects, and so this is essentially kind of getting rid of some dead weight loss, because instead of them paying the tax and then getting it back as grants, this just gives them an exemption.
It would not hit our target because this is a non-general fund, but if you can see kind of the point I was thinking there, you know, yes, I guess in that fund they're losing the money, but they're making it up and not paying the sales tax and buying the equipment. So if the Senate could just think about it a little more.
We'll think about that. We'll think about it, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Maybe give me an opportunity to talk to Senator Dibble. And
okay.
Just so I understand what his reaction is.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then back to solar and amendments and the energy. Are folks ready for that? Or do we need to recess for 5 minutes? Who are we looking to? 5 minutes?
Do we have the amendment?
Do we need to read? Oh, are you ready?
No, we got copies over there.
Oh, okay. Great. And while we're getting the copies, do people see anything else on this list that we think we could deal with tonight? I don't think so. Senator Dietzick.
Madam Chair, it's not on the list, but I had conversations. It's blurry if it was yesterday or Friday with Metro Cities and others from the metropolitan area on the special service district. And as we had those conversations regarding, and to remind people, this was on setting up special service districts, and part of the change had to do with now you have a lot of commercial on the bottom, and then you might have two or three floors of residential up above. And so the more questions we kind of looked into, the more questions we got. And so we would like to postpone that for now, and we will continue that discussion over the interim.
Great, thank you. Appreciate that, Senator Dietzick.
You did it.
Are there other things people can think of that we can do while we get the amendments? We have the amendments.
Slight.
Okay, so are you?
We're ready.
Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair and Representative Davney members, this is the amendment that would deal with the classification of the land underneath the solar factory. And so we would classify that as CI, and then if a solar panel goes up on a building, house, or another commercial industrial building, it would not impact the underlying classification for the building. I look at Mr. Sylvia to make sure I said that properly.
Madam Chair and Senator Scoy, that's correct.
The motion. What's the motion?
I would move the A84 amendment. And if Mr. Sylvia could give us the article section.
Mr. Sylvia.
Madam Chair and members, it's page 4 of the side-by-side. It's House Article 2, Section 3.
Okay. And that's on the cheat sheet here that we have, too. That. So Senator Scoy moves the A84 to House Article 2, Section 3. Is that your motion?
I believe that would do it, yes.
Okay, so discussion on the amendment. All those say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The A84 is adopted. Now to the eight, are you moving the House Article Section 3? Is that the motion we need, Mr. Sylvia? Right.
Yes. Mr. Okay. Sylvia, could you give us the motion I think it's House Article 2, Section 6 and House Article 2... Yeah, we need to do the production.
Yes, 3 and 6.
Madam Chair, for the solar energy production tax, it would be House Article 2, Section 6.
Okay, so first let's move. Should we move House Article 2, Section 3 as amended by the A84?
Yes.
We had not done that base one yet. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. The House Article 2, Section 3 as amended by the A84 is adopted. So now Senators... Goy wants to move House Article 2, Section 6. Is that your motion?
That would be my motion.
Is there another amendment?
That's on the next one.
Yeah, okay. So that's the solar energy production tax. Everyone understands House Article 2, Section 6. Discussion. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. That's adopted. And Senator or Representative Davney, who's got the last piece? Senator Scott?
I'll move that too, I think.
Okay.
And Mr. Sylvia, could you direct us to where in the Senate bill the
study
languages on the solar study? So Representative Davney has an oral amendment to make the study language.
Madam Chair and members, on the side-by-side, it's found on page 9. It's Senate Article 1, Section 33. And in the text of the Senate bill, it is found on page 24.
Page 24. Ready for your amendment.
Madam Chair, Mr. Michael, do you have an amendment for us?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, on the Senate bill, page 25, line 2, after the word taxed, we would insert in Minnesota and bordering states. And then on line 25, on page 25, line 4, after systems, insert in Minnesota and bordering states. That would extend the study to include analysis of Wisconsin, Iowa, North and South Dakota.
Does everybody have that? Mr. Chair?
Madam Chair, should I incorporate that, or do you want to move it as an oral amendment, whichever way works? Maybe just move it. It'll be easier.
But Madam Chair, I'd move that language.
Okay. So everyone got the Mr. Michael motion?
You get it.
And we're just not sure that everyone can hear it. Ms. Schell?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I was just conferring with Ms. McQuay with respect to the appropriation language to make sure it is a one-time appropriation and that monies are available as intended, and I need to look at the language in particular to tell you where that would be specifically on which line.
So we could adopt the oral language, though, that Mr. Michael is talking about first.
True.
Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, to make this explicit, I think what we would want to do is to say on page 24, line 34, after the period, insert, this is a one-time appropriation and is not added to the base budget.
Does everybody have that? Commissioner?
Madam Chair, one of the concerns, our immediate concern would be that expanding the scope of the study might require us to bring in hire an outside consultant. We had anticipated being able to do this study in-house, and now we're sort of expanding beyond the four corners of Minnesota, and the scope of the study itself is kind of beyond just the energy efficient system. So I'm just concerned about, we can address this obviously later at the end of when we get close to the cost, but I'm concerned about the fiscal cost at $150,000 being enough.
Yeah. Mr. Chair?
Well, Madam Chair and Commissioner Franz, you know, maybe it, well, I think what our expectation here is not that we actually go and travel to these states and see what they're doing. It's just to do a little online research and see what their tax rates are. I would hope that we wouldn't be doing an extensive review, but just getting a little base idea of what's going on outside the state, and we could keep this to a minimal cost.
Mr. Chair, and you know, the way I'm thinking about it, we know this bill that we are going to have to use some resources so that the Department of Revenue can implement everything in this bill. And so I hope we can have ongoing conversations about that and consider it before we're done here. Mr. Commissioner, is that okay?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sure.
Thank you. We're going to ask Mr. Michael. We're going to ask Mr. Michael to repeat that new combined oral amendment that actually is coming out of Representative Dabney's mouth. It's just Mr. Michael's going to say it. Is that okay? So we can hear it again. Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, do you want me to go through the all elements or just the one? Okay. All right. The amendment will be on page 24, line 34, after the period, insert. This is a one-time appropriation and is not added to the base budget. Page 25, line 2, after taxed, insert, in Minnesota and bordering states. Page 25, line 4, after systems, insert, in Minnesota and bordering states.
So, Dabney, is that your motion?
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
So that's on the page.
So this is Senate Article 1, Section 33.
Amended with the oral amendment.
Well, I'm moving the amendment, and I think Senator Scoy is moving the article.
Okay.
So I will move that amendment
Okay. We understand that now. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. That's adopted. And now to the base provision, Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll move the Senate Article 1, Section 33 as amended. And we'll continue the dialogue on what we're going to work with the department on covering costs.
Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. That's been adopted.
Thank you.
We think we're done for the night, so we want to hear what you think. You know, Representative Slocum really wants you to open your hearts, right? Representative Slocum, before you go home. Representative Slocum.
Madam Chair, I really think we could get this done. And so I was kind of concerned because I checked to see if I would need to recuse myself because I own a rescue dog and cat. And, you know, I donate money to these organizations every year because they saved my dog's life and my cat's life. And I just think we should say, hey, you know what, go forth from now on and sin no more. But I think we should do amnesty for these organizations. They operate on a shoestring, volunteers. I'm tugging at your heartstrings. Do you want to see my dog's picture?
Representative Davis.
Madam Chair, I just want to let Senator Rest know that I believe both the puppy and the kitten were from Marshall.
Madam Chair,
all the medical devices.
One of the medical device industry people is from Marshall. And if we can include that provision along with the amnesty, we're good to go.
Only they both cost $20,000 instead of just one of them, I think. Or is it 40? I can't recall.
Madam
well,
Chair.
I think Representative Slocum's going to keep you thinking about this. Yes. Representative Slocum.
Who's being a Grinch?
Yeah.
Oh.
And my heart is going to double in size.
Oh. Chance
to review this overnight.
Can we do this?
Took Representative David's a long time to wear us down, and so there's hope. But I wonder if we wouldn't be wise to think about this tomorrow.
Okay,
or
well,
Tuesday, actually.
I think Representative Slocum will be thinking about this.
I will be too.
I think you'll be seeing little kitties and puppies in your dreams tonight.
I really do like it. I really do like little kitties. They're so fun.
Senator Russ.
Now we do the same thing in our family. We have a duck tolling retriever who was abused in California and was rescued, and he loves my little dog a lot. His name is Fozzie, but he was from California, not Marshall. We all have that. All of us, or some of us, are real animal lovers. So. I'll consult with my grandson. He usually has a good head on his shoulders about whether they should get amnesty or not, and we'll see.
Senator Russ, can you provide us with your grandson's
telephone
number or email address? Just kidding. Representative Slocum.
Well, my little Orpheus.
Orpheus.
Little Prince of Darkness.
Oh, you got
because
the wrong
that's
myth.
Where he came from. He came from Kansas City. Starving, rained on, homeless. And he's got some psychological issues from it. Okay. But I'll save that in case I need to soften you up some more.
I can, Madam Chair, I can go one better.
Senator Russ.
Senate committee staff person imported her rescue dog from Mexico. Nowhere near Marshall. And we're talking about devotion to rescues. So we understand it, but right now we're on hold.
Madam Chair?
Representative Dabney.
We also own a rescue dog named Aspen. Beautiful, beautiful pooch, husky mix.
And when we go to the pet food store to buy another, you know, 50-pound bag of food, they always offer when you're checking out, would you like to make a donation to animal homeless shelter? And my wife always says, no, I'm buying dog food. That's my donation to the homeless animals.
Right.
So a little different attitude there
yeah.
in my household.
Don't adopt this provision. They might have to have a sign that says, can you pay our sales tax for us?
I'm going to give it a lot of thought. I was worried about Representative David sleeping the other evening. Now I'm worried about myself.
Chair Skoy could take care of that tonight.
I had a good night's sleep.
Okay, well, thank you, Representative Slocum. I know she's going to work on you there. So, Senator Skoy, what's your plan? We're going to adjourn, and you tell us what we're up to.
Madam Chair, it looks like the Senate has a real long day on the floor tomorrow, and we need to do some real pencil sharpening on our spreadsheet tomorrow. So I'm thinking Tuesday, and I would do it at the call of the chair, but I'm planning on morning. And we'll see where that goes, but Tuesday morning would look like probably the next meeting.
Anything else? If not, we're adjourned. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.